This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening. Thank you, Nigella, for that very nice introduction. And it's a real honor and a pleasure and privilege for me to be here tonight to tell you about protecting our living ocean resources. Now, many of you are probably aware that NOAA is a federal government agency. In fact, our claim to fame is predicting the weather, particularly hurricanes. But there are a whole other number of branches of NOAA, and one of those is NOAA Fisheries, often referred to as National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS. The NMFS is often referred to as the wet side of NOAA because we actually go out on the ocean and get wet. Our mission is stated here. It's stewardship of living marine resources through science-based conservation and management and the promotion of healthy ecosystems. In a nutshell, I say that NMFS is all about keeping the oceans safe. I've underlined this word science-based because our main mission is to achieve these goals through conducting research. And it is the six science centers that conduct that research. There are six science centers in NMFS in each of the four corners of the contiguous United States: the Northeast, the Southeast, the Northwest, the Southwest, Hawaii, and Alaska. And each of these are paired with a policy-focused region. So the science centers conduct the research. The regional offices do the management and enforcement. The science centers themselves are co-located on university campuses, and that is no accident. We're co-located on university campuses because of our science-based mission. Our research foci include sustaining fisheries, protecting marine species, and conserving marine habitat. And this research is guided by legal mandates. Another one of our important components is education and outreach. Outreach efforts such as this one are this evening, they're also very important to our mission. And again, it's a real honor for me to be here. So I'm going to focus on one of these science centers, this one in particular, the Southwest Fisheries Science Center. We have five research divisions. Two of them are focused on fish and abalone, the Fisheries Resource and Fisheries Ecology divisions. One of them is focused on environmental data products, that's the Environmental Research Division. One on krill, fish, and their predators, the Antarctic Research Division. And the one that I'm going to focus on for the rest of this evening, the Marine Mammal and Turtle Division, the one that I'm for which I am the director. The mission of the Marine Mammal and Turtle Division is fivefold. Our core mission is really all about assessment. It's to assess marine mammals and turtles relative to management objectives in U.S. EEZ waters or waters where the U.S. has a vested interest. And I'll return to that in a moment. But our other four components of our mission are to identify and mitigate threats to those animals, support users of our data, educate and build capacity, and advance the science of management and conservation. Now, this is the mission of our own particular science center here in La Jolla, but it is really the mission of all of the science centers within the National Marine Fisheries Service. Let me return to our core mission, that of assessment. We view that there are five required components of assessment, and those are to estimate abundance of animals, to monitor their status and trends, is the abundance increasing or decreasing in particular? To identify units to conserve, and by that I mean population structure, to assess condition and health, and finally to place all of the above in an ecosystem context. These components of our mission stem directly from our two primary mandates that I mentioned a few minutes ago, and these are going to be familiar to you, at least in name. The first one is the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which tells us that we must maintain populations at what are known as optimum sustainable levels, and importantly, as functioning elements of their ecosystem. It was the first act to have ever been passed to place individual species in a broader ecosystem context and to recognize that the ecosystem health is important to the health of those animals. The second mandate that's important to us is the Endangered Species Act. That too will be familiar in name to almost everyone here. That tells us that we need to protect, prevent extinction and recover species. And these are essentially the components of those acts that drive the type of research that we do. I'll mention that our mandates require research outside of U.S. EEZ waters or exclusive economic zone waters, and that is specifically because the marine mammals and the turtles that we study, they do not recognize geopolitical boundaries. So, our primary geographic responsibilities include a lot of ocean that is outside of U.S. waters. Here's our first area of responsibility, the California Current. I've drawn a box from the U.S.-Mexico border to the U.S.-Canada border, but in fact our research takes us to the north and to the south because we try to stay in the ecosystem of the California Current that extends about seaward to 300 nautical miles offshore. It's a big area, 1.3 million square kilometers of ocean. A second geographic region that we focus on is the Central Pacific in support of our sister science center in the Pacific Islands. Here are two of those regions, the exclusive economic zone around the Hawaiian main islands and the entire archipelago, as well as the waters around two of the U.S. protectorates, Johnston and Palmyra. In fact, in the Central Pacific, there are a whole host of other atolls for which the United States is responsible. These are just two that we've conducted research in. Either one of them is very large, about twice the size of our California Current study area at 2.2 million square kilometers. And then the third area of special focus is this area between San Diego, Hawaii, and central Peru, the waters in between that we refer to as the Eastern Tropical Pacific. It's a huge area of ocean, slightly more than 20 million square kilometers, and I'm going to talk a lot more about that later on this evening. So these are our primary geographic responsibilities, but in fact we conduct research around the world, especially in waters around both coasts of South America, some off the coast of Africa, much in the far western Pacific, in Indonesia, the Philippines, Australia, and Southeast Asia. And finally, we do a fair bit of research in Antarctica. Because our geographic areas are so oceanic, our ship time assets are critical. Historically, we have benefited from 240 sea days every year aboard two NOAA research vessels that have traditionally been used in the fall. Those vessels are the MacArthur II and the David Starr Jordan. These vessels are aging, as is the case of the entire NOAA fleet, and in many cases, NOAA ships are being retired. The David Starr Jordan was retired in 2010, and the MacArthur II is now in warm layup. So we're suffering a dearth of ship time right now, but looking forward to the replacement of the David Starr Jordan, the Lasker, which will be home ported here in San Diego and arrive, we hope, sometime later on this coming fall. We have four types of major field efforts that we do in our division: research vessel surveys, aerial surveys, shore-based surveys, and small boat-based research. And let me tell you just a little bit about each one. We have two types of research vessel surveys. The first one I refer to as abundance and ecosystem assessment surveys. Those are surveys that we do in the geographic regions that I showed you earlier. We survey the California Current on a 3 to 4 year cycle, the Eastern Tropical Pacific on a 3 to 4 year cycle, although lately that's been lengthened, that periodicity, and then the Central Pacific in irregular intervals. These abundance and ecosystem assessment surveys use a multidisciplinary approach, and we've embraced that since 1986. So a major focus is to collect data that allow us to estimate abundance of particularly the marine mammals in that area. But we have a whole host of projects also that are focused on the biology of those same species that allow us to look at population structure, behavior of those animals, life history and condition, and passive acoustics. And then the third component of these of this research cruises is ecosystem assessment, where we try to characterize the ecosystem as comprehensively as possible from top to bottom. So we collect information on physical and biological habitat for these marine mammals in the form of oceanography. We collect data on low and mid-trophic fishes and invertebrates, which represent prey of those marine mammals, and then apex predators, which represent competitors and commensals. Now, I told you we have two types of research vessel surveys. This is the second type. It's a question-based cruise. It's a one-time cruise where we ask specific questions that can be answered with a single survey, allow us to elucidate mechanisms, and advance our science. I've listed a whole bunch of different question-based cruises here, and I'll just talk briefly about this one. How many humpback whales are there in the North Pacific, which was a cruise that we conducted in 2004. In 2004, we conducted a cruise to come up with the total estimated number of humpback whales in the North Pacific as a preface to possibly efforts to downlist that species. And I'm pleased to say that there are humpback whales in the North Pacific have recovered, and our agency is undergoing some exercises now to begin the process of downlisting that species and taking it off the endangered list. So a real success story there. I mentioned that another type of research we do is based on aerial platforms. We use fixed-wing aircraft to look at marine turtles because they're very difficult to detect from ships. So we fly transects such as this one off the central coast of California to look for this animal, leatherback turtles, which feed here in great numbers. We also use aerial surveys to conduct research on cetacean abundance, condition, and life history. And here we rely heavily on aerial photographs, such as this one, which allow us to, for example, identify cow-calf pairs and determine the number of cow-calf pairs in a particular school of dolphins and track that over time. These aerial photographs also allow us to measure individual dolphins and not only tell length, but width, which is a measure of condition and health. And then finally, we use aerial surveys to assess pinniped abundance, mostly by taking, again, aerial photographs of pinnipeds when they're hauled out on beaches, and then we can count those pinnipeds and make time trends, as this one, where you can see that California sea lions have increased dramatically over time here in the California current. A third type of research that we do is shore-based surveys. We do these for gray whales because gray whales are so coastal, and we have two types of surveys for gray whales. One that we conduct from Granite Canyon site here in central California to count gray whales as they're migrating south along the coast from their feeding grounds in Alaska and Canada down to the breeding grounds in Mexico. The second type of shore-based survey is, again, for gray whales, when they are migrating to the north. We conduct this survey from the Piedras Blancas Light Station, which is also in central California, right near the Hearst Castle, if anyone of you have been there. This is really a survey that we focus on calves. We try to get calf production on an annual basis, and that allows us to track how well the animals are doing with respect to reproductive output. These are long time series. We've been conducting the calf production survey since 1994. It's going on right now, actually, as we speak. And the southbound gray whale abundance survey has been going on since 1964. And then the final type of research that we do is conducted from small boats, and this is in two regions. One, the larger Southern California Bight, which is really focused on dolphin health assessment. The Southern California Bight is adjacent to some of the most heavily populated cities on the planet, and it's important for us to be able to monitor dolphin health here as an index of the health of the ecosystem in general. And then also we do green turtle ecology right here in San Diego Bay. I don't know how many of you are aware that there's a resident population of green turtles in South San Diego Bay, and we go out when they are there and do a wide variety of research projects on them. In addition to these field projects, we have a host of laboratories at our new site, which is actually right next door to Birch Aquarium now, that we just recently moved into. It includes some laboratories that allow us to do molecular genetics work, photogrammetry, stable isotopes, hormone assays, a look at life history and condition of animals, and study passive acoustics. Our division is consisted of 7 science programs and 1 implementation program, some 80 talented and dedicated individuals that make this all happen. I want to just give you 4 slides to give you an overview sampling of some of our research highlights. This is one that I like to start with because it emphasizes how important collecting ecosystem data in addition to data on the species that we manage is. And in this example, we have used ecosystem data to predict beaked whale abundance and distribution. So here are some sightings in the blue dots of Cuvier's beaked whale, a relatively rare whale, in the study region. And this is a representation of some of the physical and biological oceanographic data that we collect on those cruises. Using relatively sophisticated mathematical models, we can combine these 2 data sets to come up with models that actually allow us to predict density of this species based on the environmental parameters in the same area. With this predicted density grid, we can draw a circle around any particular area and come up with the number of Cuvier's beaked whales in any particular area. This is very important to any users of the marine environment, such as the Navy, for example. They're not only interested in avoiding areas of high cetacean density, but when they complete their environmental impact statements, they can use this tool that we've developed to comply with the requirements that tell them that they must estimate the number of individuals that will be impacted by these activities. Another research highlight that I want to mention is our ability to identify cetaceans to the species level using nothing but their vocalizations. And this is based on our passive acoustic research. Here's an example of some of the data that we collect. And the application is that passive acoustics may ultimately allow us to monitor some species without the use of these expensive ship time altogether. Here's a third sampling of research that I wanted to highlight for you. It goes back to that long time series of our gray whale calf production. Here's the time series here with the number of calves produced in red, and you can see that fluctuates quite wildly from year to year. In blue, there's an ice index, and you can see that gray whale calf numbers track ice condition very closely. The application here is that gray whales are ecosystem sentinels of the effects of climate change, and we're looking more and more to gray whales to tell us more about the greater ecosystem, particularly in the Arctic where they feed. And then the final research highlight that I want to give you here tonight has to do with satellite telemetry of leatherback turtles. Leatherback turtles nest over here in the far western Pacific, but these pink lines represent individual turtles that were fitted with satellite tags, and you can see that when they leave the breeding beaches, they migrate all the way across the entire Pacific and go to their foraging areas here in the California Current and up in the northern Pacific. These satellite tracks have allowed us to identify high-use areas such as Monterey Bay, which is an important feeding area for this critically endangered turtle. The application is that we can use these satellite tracks to identify critical habitat and then to protect it. We have a lot more research that we do, but now what I'd like to do is move on and give you an overview of NOAA and the Eastern Tropical Pacific. And I'm going to start with a definition of the Eastern Tropical Pacific, which I may actually refer to in an abbreviated form in the rest of this talk as the ETP. The definitions for this region vary, but for us, it is the known range of spotted and spinner dolphins stocks that are affected by the yellowfin tuna purse seine fishery, and I'll talk more about that purse seine fishery in a moment. So when I speak about the ETP, I'm really speaking about this blue polygon that I pointed out a little bit earlier. And I want to make two points about it here. One is that it's truly oceanic because the continental shelf of the entire Central American and South American coast is very narrow. So this is off-the-shelf water, oceanic. And it's also extremely large. As I mentioned earlier, it's slightly more than 21 million square kilometers of ocean. Now, many of you are likely familiar with the tuna-dolphin issue and dolphin-safe tuna. In the Eastern Tropical Pacific, there's an association between yellowfin tuna, spotted and spinner dolphins, and tuna-dependent seabirds that forms the basis for one of the world's largest tuna fisheries. In fact, that association is a hallmark of the Eastern Tropical Pacific, this prevalence of these multi-species aggregations. And you can see this photograph shows some of those dolphins co-schooling with these very large yellowfin tuna. The dolphins and seabirds provide a very clear visual signal of the location of surface tuna schools. So under normal circumstances, without this aggregation, you would never dream of going out into the ocean and visually looking for a tuna school. But in the Eastern Tropical Pacific, because these tuna school with dolphins that are air-breathing animals and big flocks of seabirds, you can go out and very easily identify and find these big tuna schools. And in the 1950s, tuna fishers began to use what they called dolphin sets to catch large schools of large tuna. These dolphin schools were visually located, chased by speedboats into a purse seine net, and the co-schooling tuna followed the dolphins and were also captured. I like this photograph because it shows you, with respect to humans, just how large these tuna are. And you can see why tuna fishers find it very valuable to go after these schools. Unfortunately, this method of fishing resulted in very high incidental mortality of dolphins. That was in the early years of the fishery. The mortality was so high that three stocks of dolphins were declared as depleted under the U.S. Marine Mammal Protection Act. It's estimated that more than 6 million dolphins have been killed since the fishery began, and the three stocks that were declared depleted are the northeastern offshore spotted, the eastern spinner dolphin, and the coastal spotted dolphin. And here you see abundance trends over time for two of those, and you can see the dramatic decrease. In the case of northeastern offshore spotteds, they're estimated to be between 19 and 28% of the pre-exploitation levels. In the case of eastern spinner dolphin, they're estimated to be at about 44% of pre-exploitation levels. In fact, it was this tuna porpoise problem that it was, as it was referred to in the early years, that was one of three drivers for the creation of the U.S. Marine Mammal Protection Act that was enacted in 1972. So grave was that problem. The tuna porpoise problem, by the way, was also the primary driver for the creation of the Southwest Fisheries Science Center's Marine Mammal and Turtle Division. Subsequent to the revelation of this dramatic incidental mortality, fishing practices began to be revised. And those fishing practices drastically reduced dolphin mortality by 1990 so that there was an expectation that depleted dolphin stocks would recover. And here is a time trend of that mortality from 1955 to 2005, showing the number of dolphins that were reported killed in the thousands. And you can see it's very high in the early years, but once the revised fishing practices were enacted, that mortality dropped to very low numbers in the 1990s, leading us to expect that dolphin stocks would recover. Now, the Southwest Fisheries Science Center has conducted cetacean and ecosystem assessment cruises here during 10 separate years over a 21-year period. And here are some of the cruise, here are all of those cruise tracks. We've conducted these cruises in every year, 86 through 1990, every year, 98 through 2000, again in 2003 and 2006. And these cruises form the basis for our analysis of the status of these dolphin stocks. Using data collected on those cruises, there is some evidence that depleted dolphins may be recovering. Here again are time trends in abundance for those three depleted stocks from 1985 through 2005 in the number of animals. What I show you here is the mean plus a coefficient of variation. And you can see that from 1998 through 2006, this latter part of the time series, these three different species stocks have increased at rates of 0.035, 0.092, and 0.077 respectively. So this gives us some reason for hope. There is a great degree of uncertainty surrounding these point estimates, though, and the 95% confidence intervals tell us that we cannot be certain that these numbers, that this line is different from no growth, zero. Regardless of what the statistics tell us, it's very clear that the dolphins are not recovering as expected. And we've subsequently been pursuing three main hypotheses to explain these abundance trends. Those are that the purse seine fishery is reducing dolphin reproduction and survival, that an oceanic regime shift has changed the ecosystem so that recovery to pre-exploitation numbers cannot occur, or that our expectation of immediate and rapid recovery is too simple. And these hypotheses are not comprehensive and they're not mutually exclusive. I'm not going to speak more about the research that we're conducting to try to disentangle these, although I'd be happy to expound on it later on after the talk. But I will come back to the purse seine fishery and let you know that purse seine sets on dolphins do continue. The number of sets on dolphins has been relatively stable for the past 20 years at about 10,000 sets per year. So this is in despite the fact that the dolphin safe label remains in place. Those dolphin sets continue and those tuna are marketed under a different label. Before I get too much into the cetacean biodiversity hotspots, let me give you an overview of cetaceans in general. Starting with the basics, cetaceans are marine mammals. And marine mammals, first of all, are mammals. That means they're endothermic, they nurse live young, they're haired, they have distinct physiological and skeletal characteristics. And marine mammals obtain food from the sea. That's the marine part of their name. Marine mammals are also K-selected. That means they live long and they live slow, much like us humans. They have low reproductive rates and long lifespans. Marine mammals include a number of different groups, the pinnipeds, which are the seals, sea lions, and walrus, the sirenians, which are manatees and dugongs, sea otters, polar bears. Some, including myself, consider fish-eating bats to be marine mammals because, after all, they are mammals and they obtain their food from the sea. And finally, cetaceans. Cetaceans are whales, dolphins, and porpoises, and they are comprised under the order Cetartiodactyla. An interesting aside about cetaceans is their closest living relative is the hippopotamus. Cetaceans are completely independent of land. They're essentially hairless. They have a well-developed blubber layer for thermoregulation. They have a greatly modified skull to allow the nostrils to be moved up to the top of the head and modified into blowholes. And they have completely lost their hind limbs, even though they evolved from terrestrial ancestors. And their pelvic bones have been greatly reduced. But let me give you an overview of the two main groups, the baleen whales and the toothed whales. The baleen whales comprise what's known as the suborder Mysticeti, which literally means mustached whale. There are four families and some 14 species in this suborder, and baleen whales have no functional teeth. Instead, they have baleen plates that they use to strain prey. And here is a close-up of those baleen plates that hang from the upper jaw. The baleen plates are made of keratin, the same material that our fingernails are made of. They are smooth on the outside, but fringed on the inside, so that when the whale opens its mouth for a gulp of water, hopefully there are small invertebrate prey items in that water, and they're able to let the water through in each of these individual plates, with the prey getting caught in the fringed part of the baleen inside. And it's this baleen that gives is the source of their mustached part of their name. Baleen whales have two external blowholes, which you can see quite clearly here with this blue whale, and they include the largest animals ever to live on the planet, and that again is this blue whale here. Let me give you a quick overview of the different families of baleen whales, starting with this one, Balaenidae. It's the right whales. There's one genus and four species. They're notable for their very slow swimming and their very strongly arched lower jaw. Another family within this group of baleen whales is Neobalaenidae. It's a very cryptic family, the pygmy right whales. There's only one genus and one species. And here's the animal swimming away from us with the two blowholes on the top. You can see why it's called a right whale, because it has this lower jaw that's arched, very similar to the proper right whales. But this photograph taken by my colleague Bob Pittman shows these whitish scars on the back. And these whitish scars are very interesting and very telling, because they're made by cookie cutter sharks, a shark that makes its living by swimming up behind larger bodied animals and scooping flesh out of their bodies. They heal well from these, but they leave marks. But what's telling about this is that cookie cutter sharks are found only in tropical oceans. So despite the fact that this animal is only known from the Southern Ocean, a very cold ecosystem, we know that at times this animal has been in tropical seas. Here's another family of baleen whales, Eschricteidae, the gray whale, which is familiar to many of you. There's only one genus and one species. That's our very own California gray whale, or the North Pacific gray whale. And then the last family in this group is Balaenopteridae, the rorquals. There are two genera and eight species. These are the largest and the fastest swimming of the baleen whales. This family includes the largest living animal on the planet, the blue whale. The smallest species in this family is the minke whale, and this inset shows an Antarctic minke whale, which is very fond of sea ice. I put this in here because, despite the fact that this is the smallest animal in this family, you can see that standing next to this Coast Guard female here, it's still a fairly large animal. It's sticking its head out of the ice, and this is just its mouth with the rest of its body down here. So these are really relatively large animals. And here is the first family that also occurs in the eastern tropical Pacific, but let me continue with my cetaceans 101 and move on to the second group of cetaceans, the toothed whales, which comprise the suborder Odontoceti, which literally means toothed odont whale, Cetus. In this suborder, there are 10 families and some 65 species. As the name implies, all of them have functional teeth, although not all of them have many teeth. Here's a close-up of a sperm whale jaw, where you can see many teeth, but in the lower jaw only. Unlike the baleen whales, the toothed whales have only one external blowhole. And sadly, there is at least one species that has gone extinct due to anthropogenic factors, That's the Yangtze River dolphin, the Baiji, which was declared extinct in the year 2007. Let me give you an overview of the families here, starting with the most ancient, Physeteridae, or the sperm whale. There's one genus and one species. You can see the teeth in the lower jaw of this sperm whale, and you can also see these white marks around the mouth. These are sucker scars from squids, evidence of battles that took place in the deep when this animal was feeding on squid. This is a photograph of live sperm whales, and this is how you see them at the surface, often very close together, packed in like sardines after a very long dive, recovering at the surface. And this species is found in the eastern tropical Pacific, so it will be a part of the research that I tell you about in a few moments. Another family in Odontocete is this one, Kogiidae. It's a rather cryptic family. There's one genus and two species. Both of those are found in the eastern tropical Pacific, the dwarf sperm whale and the pygmy sperm whale. Here's another family of odontocetes, Ziphioidae, the beaked whales. They are perhaps the most bizarre family of mammals on the planet, in my opinion. There are 6 genera and 21 species and counting. New species are continually being described, and there are several species in this family that are known only from skeletal remains on beaches. So cryptic are they. They are very unusual in that they have, most species have only 2 teeth in the lower jaw and only of males. Here's a close-up of an animal that is swimming along at the surface. Here's its mouth and the 2 teeth that are protruding up on the lower jaw. There are 5 species of beaked whales that are found in the eastern tropical Pacific, and I've listed those here. The river dolphins are also part of the Odontocete, the toothed whales. They used to be considered a single family because they all looked very similar. But now we know that that similarity is the result of convergent evolution. In fact, they are very old lineages, and they comprise 4 separate families. Each one has its own genus and 4 separate species, and it was this one that was declared extinct in 2007. So not only did the world lose a species, we lost an entire family. This is a photograph of that Yangtze River dolphin, the Baiji. The next family in this group is the Monodontidae. There are 2 genera and 2 species. They are the beluga and this bizarre animal, the narwhal, which has this left upper canine tooth, which actually erupts out of the upper lip and spirals left to form this amazing tusk. The second to last family in this group, the Delphinidae, it's probably the one that's most familiar to all of you, and it's quite speciose. There are 17 genera and 36 species, and they include some drab forms as well as these really striking black and white forms. This particular one is the southern right whale dolphin. There's a northern right whale dolphin, a different species, but looks very similar to that found right here in our own California current. And then there's this really beautiful animal also that's found in southern ocean areas, the hourglass dolphin. And in the eastern tropical Pacific, we have 15 species of delphinid. There are quite a few species there, and I'll talk more about them in a minute. And then finally, the last family in this group is Phocoenidae. It's the porpoises. There are 3 genera and 6 species, including this one, Doll's porpoise, which is also a black and white form found here in the California current offshore, as well as this really, really cute animal that's found in coastal regions of Southeast Asia and rivers, and looks for all the world like E.T., I think. All right, I'm going to conclude my talk now by getting a little bit more into some science that we've done in the eastern tropical Pacific on cetaceans, and I'm going to talk to you about what we know about cetacean biodiversity hotspots. The term hotspot was first coined in the late 1980s by scientist Myers, who was interested in identifying regions on land which contained the greatest number of species with the idea that you could protect small tracts of land and therefore conserve great amounts of biodiversity. So it's this hotspot concept that's really been used heavily in terrestrial conservation biology and is beginning to be used more and more now in marine conservation biology. Hotspots have a variety of different definitions. I've put a couple of them up here. Areas where exceptional concentrations of endemic species are experiencing exceptional loss of habitat, or simply areas particularly rich in species, rare species, threatened species, or some combination. And again, the search for these hotspots has been of great interest to conservation biologists. And we, too, have gotten on that bandwagon. I'm going to borrow some research that I've conducted recently with three colleagues, Jessica Redfern, Paul Fiedler, and Robert Pittman, and I want to acknowledge them here. Now, I've talked to you already about the Eastern Tropical Pacific, but I haven't told you much about the oceanography. The oceanography is very important here. There are three major surface currents, the North Equatorial Current that flows off the California Current and flows to the west, the Equatorial Countercurrent that flows to the east, and the South Equatorial Current that flows to the west, as well as two mesoscale surface features, the Costa Rica Dome here off the coast of Costa Rica, and the Equatorial Front, where the Equatorial Current and the Equatorial Countercurrent meet. I'll talk more about those in a moment. In particular, these three regions I'll come back to near the end of the talk. Temporal variation in this oceanography can be significant, and it occurs on two temporal scales. First, seasonally. What I've shown you here are the four seasons in the Eastern Tropical Pacific and quarterly deviations from the mean sea surface temperature. Now, that's a lot of jargon. What I really want you to focus on is the colors here. And just notice that the colors are different in the different seasons. That's telling us that there's seasonal variability out there with respect to surface temperature. There's a lot of interannual variability as well. What you see here is a 100-year time series from 1900 through the year 2000. And again, sea surface temperature anomaly from the average zero here over time in two regions of the Eastern Tropical Pacific, in orange and red. And what you can see here is quite clearly there's a lot of variation in sea surface temperature in that region from 1 year to the next. Now, the data that we collected in the Eastern Tropical Pacific spans this particular suite of years and these two seasons. As I mentioned earlier, our field research was conducted aboard NOAA research vessels on the cetacean and ecosystem assessment surveys that I told you about a little bit earlier. The data that we used come from those 10 years over a 23-year time span in the fall, and they comprise a total of slightly more than 2,000 sea days. To collect our cetacean data, we use state-of-the-art line transect methods. We have three marine mammal observers on effort on the ship's flying bridge at any one time. They're looking through these very large mounted binoculars that are 25 power. They allow us to see all the way out to the horizon and look for cetaceans, and we conduct those observations during all daylight hours whenever the sea state is less than Beaufort 6 or the wind speed is less than about 25 knots. So, using those methods, our data comprise slightly more than 15,000 sightings of whales and dolphins of a total of 28 cetacean species, or about one-third of the world's cetaceans are out there. Now, I'm going to give you just a quick overview of our analytical methods that we used to identify these hotspots. We calculated species density. From that, we got species richness and then moved to our hotspots. Our objective here was to focus on spatial variation. We're looking for hotspots spatially. We collapsed all the temporal variation and looked at all 10 years of data as a single unit. This is a scary slide that shows you how we calculated density using this formula and a lot of data that went into understanding what these values were. I'm going to skip over all of that and just tell you that we calculated density with our data for every single day that we were out there. And what we then got was in the study area a density value for each of those days, 2,116 densities. Using those daily densities, then we smooth those densities to come up with a density map for any particular species. And I'm going to show you more of these maps in a few moments. This one for a common dolphin in this case shows low densities or zero in white with progressively higher density of animals in the darker blues. And it's these smooth density maps and this color pattern that I'll show in the subsequent slides. Another piece of information, you'll notice that this is somewhat of a grainy map. That is because we smoothed our maps using a resolution of 100 by 100 kilometers. So we have 100 by 100 kilometer squares here, and those densities are smooth on that resolution. After we calculated density, we needed to calculate richness. We derived that from species-specific density because if we looked at the sightings alone, they're somewhat biased. And here's what I mean. Suppose we wanted to use all of our data and just look at the sightings of a particular species, Fraser's dolphin, in this case. Now, let's say we're interested in the richness of Fraser's dolphin in this area. Now, it's hard to tell whether there are no Fraser's dolphins here or whether there aren't any Fraser's dolphins just because we didn't look there. That's an important difference. And if we add the areas where we looked in these white dots, you can see that we're pretty confident that, in fact, we did not see any Fraser's dolphins in that circle because we went out there and looked quite a bit. So this is why we use our richness, calculate our richness from density, because it incorporates this effort. We defined richness simply as the total number of species in any particular grid cell. And in order to do that, we had to convert density to presence and absence. Again, I'm going to skip over the details here and just tell you that we had two types of species. Species that we consider to be abundant or widespread, such as this pygmy sperm whale here. In those cases, we used 33% of the grid cells with the highest density to indicate presence. And then there were species that we considered to be rare or localized, such as this Pacific white-sided dolphin, in which case we used all of the grid cells with any density and considered those species to be present. So you roll that all together, and here's our species richness map of the eastern tropical Pacific. Areas where there are white squares represent areas where there were no species seen at all, and there aren't very many of those here, as you can see. Almost everywhere we saw just a few, at least a few species, with progressively greater number of species in progressively darker shades of blue. So you can quite quickly tell that areas of highest species richness are along the coast here, around the Galapagos, maybe extending along out here, along the south of the equator. Some pretty rich areas out here as well to the far west. Again, the species pool was 28 total species. In any one of these squares, we had no more than 19 species per grid cell. Finally, to get to the hot spot concept, we defined hot spots as grid cells containing more than 40% of the species or more than 10 species in any one of our grid cells. And here's where those hot spots were. So here I've shown any place where there are fewer than 10 species or fewer than 11 species in white and greater than 10 species in red. So the hot spots are along the coast of Baja California, here off the coast of Costa Rica, here around the Galapagos, as well as a few other areas. And I'm going to spend my last few minutes trying to address this question. What is the significance of these hotspots? Hotspots seem to include important areas for some species, that is, areas of highest density. And here's an example. Again, this is a figure I showed you earlier for the common dolphin with highest densities in blue. And you can see that many of those areas of high density are encompassed by the hotspots, which I have outlined in heavy black here. Here's another example of that, blue whale in this case. Here too, many of the areas of highest density for blue whales are also encompassed by hotspots. But in general, the correlation between richness and density is fairly low. Here I've shown you for melon-headed whale the density on this axis and species richness here. And what you can see is that melon-headed whales have a lot of different density values at a lot of different richness values. But at high richness values, they're not particularly dense. In fact, this was true for all of the species. The mean correlation was only 0.26, which is a relatively low correlation value, ranging from a high of 0.5 for that common dolphin that I showed you a few minutes ago to a low of just 0.08 for tropical bottlenose whale. And the proportion of cells where a species was present and encompassed by hotspots was generally low. Here's what I mean. Here is a density plot for pygmy sperm whale. And here you can see the area where the animal was located and the hotspots outlined in black. In this particular case, 40% of the area in which this species was present was also encompassed by hotspots. And I'm going to call that value the overlap in the next few slides. Here's an example of another species, Pacific white-sided dolphin. Here the overlap was relatively high. 58% of the area where this species was present is also encompassed by hotspots. But that area drops to a lot lower value when we start to look at more tropical species. Here is the map for Stenobrettanensis, the rough-toothed dolphin, with the overlap only 18%. Here's another example, striped dolphin. The overlap is 21%. Spotted dolphin, one of those depleted dolphin stocks that I talked about earlier, the overlap is 19%. Spinner dolphin, another depleted stock where the overlap is only 11%. Here are some of the bigger delphinids. This is Risso's dolphin. The overlap is 16%. Pilot whale, the overlap is 14%. And in fact, this was generally true of all species. The proportion of area where that species was present and encompassed by hotspots was generally low, a mean of only 20%. Overlap. So why is this? Why do hotspots encompass such a small proportion of the area in which a species is present? Well, for starters, these hotspots are clearly correlated with oceanography. So here is a composite satellite image of sea surface chlorophyll of the eastern tropical Pacific and our hotspots here. And I'll draw your attention to two of our three hotspots. This one here, off the coast of Costa Rica, which is clearly correlated with this blush of productivity that we know in oceanographic terms as the Costa Rica Dome. And the second one, this hot spot here around the Galapagos, is clearly correlated with this blush of productivity and the greater equatorial front, which is the interface between these two currents, one moving westward and the other moving eastward. In fact, these hotspots seem to be coincident with oceanographic variability. So here's one of those, an additional oceanographic slide, which shows the change in sea surface temperature between El Niño and La Niña. It's a relatively complicated figure, but here too, let me just ask you to focus on the colors and the dark colors in general. The darker the color, the greater the variability. Here are our hotspots, and notice that the variability in the areas of the hotspots tends to be relatively high. In fact, these hotspots appear to lie along oceanographic edges. This hotspot is the edge between the south equatorial Current and the North Equatorial Countercurrent. Where they meet is the equatorial front, and this is a hot spot. The Costa Rica Dome is an edge of this cyclonic gyre in oceanographic terms and surrounding water around it. And then the final hot spot is the interface between the North Equatorial Current and the Equatorial Countercurrent. Now remember that our hot spots represent spatial variation. I told you that we collapsed all of the data from all 10 years together and averaged them to give a spatial representation. We're ignoring temporal variation in our analysis. And this has led us to this hypothesis that these edges shift spatially over time, and it's that shift that caused these areas to be richness hotspots. We think that they're catching the edges of distributions of a great many species. So are these biodiversity hotspots a valuable way to identify regions of high conservation priority? We're currently continuing to investigate that question. Here's an example of the types of analyses we're doing. This shows species richness and versus species density for a suite of species. And again, similar to the pattern that I showed you earlier, at high species richnesses, we don't see particularly high species densities. We see highest species densities where richness is intermediate. So here, density is highest in regions of moderate richness. This leads us to question the significance of these high richness hotspots to conservation. This question then becomes critical if you're interested in conservation biology in this oceanic area. To what extent do hotspots describe important areas for component species? If, as we believe may be the case, hotspots represent edge habitat for these component species, they may in fact be of little value for conserving those cetaceans here. It's clear that understanding the significance of species richness hotspots is critical to successful conservation, and we'll be spending more of our time doing that in the coming months. For now, I think I'll stop and thank you once again for the kind invitation. I'll take questions if there is time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.